Hey, everybody. Welcome back for season two of the Broken Banquet Podcast. This season, we've got more interviews with missionaries around the world, more interviews with authors who have written amazing books about missions, and more conversations about what it means for us to abide with one another. And yes, probably a story or two about Ashley taking a walk, eating food, or having drinks with someone who she now loves. We're so glad you're back. We're glad to be back. And we hope that you will enjoy this episode.
So, Will.
Yes, Ashley.
I've been very excited about today ever since we talked to John Woodward this morning, because I get to introduce you to another friend of mine. You've met Julie Dodge.
Yes.
You've met Mitch Arbelez.
Yes.
You've met John Woodward a gazillion times.
Yes.
You met Stefania.
Yes.
a lot, too. and you met Patrick Marunga.
Have I met everyone in your cohort?
You nearly met everyone in my Doctor of Ministry cohort.
I think I should get a Doctor of Ministry just because I've met everyone that was in your cohort. Can you work on that?
I can work on it. Okay. We'll have to have Jason Clark on next. And okay. that way you can...
Is he the one? His name on
yeah.
the thing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
That would be good.
Let's work on that.
All right, Jason, you're up next. But now you get to meet Dave Persad. And I love Dave so much because one day it was somebody in his family's birthday and it made it on Facebook that he was saying happy birthday to this person in his family. Well, then somebody thought, oh, well, it must be Dave's birthday. And so it became this chain of events of happy birthday, Dave, happy birthday, Dave, happy birthday. It became such a big deal that every time we saw Dave from there on out, we just said, Dave, happy birthday.
Thanks.
So much so that by the time we ended up in Cape Town and then in Hong Kong, we were singing to him in person. And then after we graduated, the tradition continued on, and they kept filming a happy birthday, Dave, video at all of the cohort meetings.
Well, happy birthday, Dave.
Well, thank you. It was actually last a week, 10 days ago, I guess, 11 days ago. So that was my actual birthday. Yeah, so 10 years later, at last fall's cohort, they sang happy birthday, Dave. And
I just love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I hope you got some presents from some of those people who mistakenly thought it was your birthday.
I got a lot of free desserts over the 3 years in our trips around the world. I didn't get a lot of free desserts at the restaurants we were in.
That'll do.
We at Cape Town, South Africa, we went to one right on the waterfront, which you'll get to go to in just a couple of months.
Oh, great.
We surprised them and they brought up the sparklers and everything. It was fantastic. Well, Dave is definitely one of the most thoughtful people I've ever met. Mm-hmm. He is a pastor. He is a missionary. He is a leader extraordinaire. Mm-hmm. He has great vision. His writing ability is one of the best that I've ever read.
Wow.
So I think that you are really going to love Dave and love getting to know him well. So Will Bailey, Dave Persat.
Nice to meet you, Dave.
Great.
Welcome to the Broken Banquet Podcast.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. It's great to be with you. All the way from up here to all the way wherever you guys are today.
Wherever we are. Where are we, Ashley? We're together,
we're
Ashley.
Together. We're together. I'm poking
office.
You.
Again, you are poking me.
I'm poking you in the shoulder.
Lizzie, and you're still poking me.
Well, Dave is in Ontario. Yes. Yeah, Canada.
That's right on the Michigan border. About an hour north of Detroit is Port Huron, Michigan. And we can see this. So there's a river that runs right between where I am and where Michigan is, and it's not separated by much.
Well, thank you for joining us. We are in San Ysidro, Costa Rica, and I'm thankful that through the miracle of electricity and internets and Zooms and whatever this program is called, we are able to be together and have this conversation. Thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be with you. I look forward to talking. Anything about mission is always exciting.
Well, that's where I want to start. I want to hear who you are, Dave. I just want you to give a little bit of a blurb about who you are. And then let's go on the journey of being a pastor and especially your El Salvador partnership, mission partnership. And then I want to hear all the new things that are happening in your life, too. So just give us the blurb to begin with, and we'll go from there.
The blurb is, I am, sorry, it's hard to believe, but it's for me to think about even. I was born in Trinidad. My family brought me to Canada. And when I was probably less than a year old, and I grew up in Ottawa, Ontario, which is the capital of Canada. My parents come from a Hindu background. And so that was part of my upbringing. They were divorced probably by the time I was maybe 11. And so that also helped shape a little bit of my, well, significantly my journey. So both my parents' faith background and the dissolving of their marriage certainly affected me for a long number of years. And it really wasn't, it wasn't until I was 19 years old that I first heard about Jesus. After dropping out of high school and then coming back to high school, that's a whole other story in itself. But then meeting people who would introduce me to Jesus and help me to understand that I have value just for who I am through that process. So that's now, it's 37, almost 37 years ago, but still feels as vibrant to me to recognize the difference that Jesus makes in my life. And many of those friendships have endured throughout all these years because of just how special they are. And so that aspect of things, understanding the difference that Jesus can make to our lives, that continues to fuel what I do, what I get to wake up and do every single day. And I just find myself incredibly fortunate to, in my brokenness, to have been found and to recognize that I have purpose because of who God is and how much he loves me. That's a lot in a little nutshell right there.
I want to just talk all about that, but let's talk about how you got from that point then to how you became a pastor.
So very early on in my Christian experience, my relationship with Jesus, I certainly felt this as I read the Bible more and listened more to the really compelling teaching that we were getting Sunday in, Sunday out from our lead pastor at the time. And just really felt this calling. I had no idea what that was, but this idea that God had more for me in just beyond attending a church. And as I certainly read the scriptures and saw what Jesus was inviting to, I thought there's something there. And I remember one day sitting in church, listening, and then it was like, just this impression that God said to me, you're going to do that. And I'm like, what does that even mean? And then our pastor at the time was 37 years old. And the impression really was me at 19 years old, as a new believer, understanding all of this, just feeling this impression that God was saying to me, when you're that age, this is what you'll be doing. I'm like, I have no idea what that even means or how that even can come about. So I heard that, and then the following year, I thought, well, if this is something that God has for me, I should probably go to Bible school. And so I ended up going to Bible school for a year. I thought I was going to be going for 4 years, but on the way back from my first year, had a terrible car accident, totaled our car, and could never afford to go back to Bible school. And there were some things going on with our family, and I thought it was important for me to be at home and serve our family during that time. And so that's what I did. I was back in Ottawa, and I was helping my family as best I could. And then I learned to serve as part of the church. And I was there that the Lord used other people to discern, hey, you have a gift for teaching. Why don't we give you a shot at this? And was really mentored significantly during those years. And so the idea of serving with my gifts, and that started to take hold. And the idea then of going to Bible school, that never seemed to be in the cards ever again. But still this thing, that full-time ministry, whatever that looks like, was important. And so as I'm back in Ottawa and this has gone on, I'm continuing to read the scripture and just this idea that God has more for me. And so I decided to quit my job a few years later, and I went to Spain for 3 months with a mission organization to learn from missionaries firsthand. So it wasn't an organized trip. I just organized, put it together myself with an organization that was willing to let me just live with some missionaries for a few weeks at a time. And we moved around Spain and got to get a sense of what they think and feel day. What is a regular day in? Not when you're entertaining a group. What does a regular day feel like living with them? And then I came back from that and tried to reintegrate into my life there. About 6 months after I came back from that, then I met the woman who would become my wife, Amanda. And we got married and talked about all of this as a possibility. I said, I think God has ministry in store for me. So if we're going to have this, you know, if we're going to go forward, we need to be open to this possibility. And she's amazing and said, yeah, I'm open to that possibility. We still had no idea. I had no post-secondary education, no formal education, but just still felt this, that God had something else. And then so through a series of events and doing youth ministry interim time at our home church in Ottawa for a little while, and then our son was born, then we moved to a different city. How's this still going to happen? Not sure. In the summer of 2000, my best man, him and I met up, and he says, you know, you need to be in ministry. I'm like, yeah, I don't know. Like, I think that ship has sailed. Like, what do you do, right? He was already in ministry. And so that fall, he invited me to come to speak to his college and career group, his young adults group in New York City. And on the way back from that experience, my plane connections, every single one got canceled. There was storms, and I ended up riding on this plane all alone, all the way back from New York City to our home. And I'm in the middle of that. I'm like, God, what is going on? Like, this was an amazing weekend. Why? Oh, then I thought, is there something else I need to be thinking about? And in that conversation, myself alone, running through airports and sitting on planes alone, coming back in the middle of the night, it became really clear that we had to do whatever it took to get involved in mission and ministry, whatever that looked like. And so I landed. I said to my wife, we got to talk. This is what's happened. I spill all that out. She says, okay, what do we got to do? I said, I think I need to go back and finish school. Well, in the midst of all of that, while I was away on that weekend teaching to this group, our home church here in Sarnia, Ontario, that we had been part of for a couple of years, they had been looking for somebody to come on staff. And they actually, on that weekend I was away, they had somebody come to be added on staff, to speak for a call to be added on staff. Well, I had no idea what happened. We were relatively new. I had no idea what happened. And so later that week, when I got back, the pastor called me and asked me if I'd consider serving on their leadership team. And I said, I'd love to, but I'm sorry. We're just about to sell everything we got, and I'm going to Bible college. And he says, oh, well, that's interesting. You feel this call to ministry. He said, we should talk about that. He says, because the person who was supposed to be was here this weekend, things just didn't work out. So we actually have a spot that's open here. Would you be interested in coming on staff here, and then we'll figure out the schooling part on your own, because we can affirm you're at this gifting, this call to ministry. So that winter of 2001 is when I first started here down the hall in ministry in Sarnia. So it's a crazy story, but it's one that I know that the Lord is in. He continues to remind me of the uniqueness of that. And so because of the support of this home church, I was able to jump into a master's degree and get a master's without having an undergrad degree, and a unique circumstance with the institute that I was in to be able to allow me that, because they based a lot of it on my experience, my mission experience and things like that. And so 23 years later, I'm still on staff here in different capacities over the years, but I love the opportunity to speak life, bring the truth of Jesus and his message to the people that he leads me to. So that's a little bit of the story there.
It's a good story, Dave. That's a good story. It's a great story. I've heard most of that before. And what I want to ask you about is, from the first moment I met you, I heard about your love for El Salvador and the partnership that you have there.
Yeah.
But hearing you talk about Spain, I'm wondering how much that experience played into your formation of this partnership with El Salvador.
Yeah, that is a really good question. So that experience in Spain for those 3 months, that has continues to challenge me and shape me. And certainly during those 3 months, the Lord gave me the capacity to understand Spanish and even speak Spanish during those 3 months. I've never had that experience again outside of those 3 months. And so certainly there was an inclination, well, if we choose El Salvador, perhaps I'll have some, the Lord will gift me again with that Spanish language understanding. That has not happened to that extent. So the choosing of El Salvador for us as a church was really a reflection of who are we as a church body, as a church family. What are our gifts and strengths? And that became so that was part of the equation. So we're compassionate, merciful people who demonstrate that most readily through in practical examples. And so we build houses through an organization called Shelter Helps, and they build houses for the poorest of the poor in the country of El Salvador. And so it spoke to the mercy, compassion piece of who we are as a church family. It also spoke to the practical aspects of how we function best. And then choosing El Salvador also because it's in the same side of the world, it doesn't require as much time away from home to be able to go. So we can go and come back in a period of 8 or 9 days. So you only have to take a 1 week off of work essentially if you want to go. And so those two things really were it fit who we are. It was an extension of the way we function locally in mission, and then it in terms of the practical nature. So now it's been 15 years that we've been participating in this.
So Dave, how do you think, or how do you hope the members of your congregation would describe that relationship? What does it mean for them? I'm sure a lot of them have been over the course of the last 15 years. I'm sure there's a lot who haven't been. But if we sort of sat everybody down at a table and asked them for them to tell us about your relationship with El Salvador, how do you feel like the church would describe that relationship?
So one of our goals in establishing a relationship, and this was the very first one in terms of a global partnership, one of our goals in that was to have a mutuality. Whatever we were going to be involved in was going to be a long-term relationship where there was mutual benefit, that we weren't going to solve anybody's problems, but we were going to benefit from what God was doing in that particular area through those particular people. And that was a foreign concept. Like 15 years ago, when you were going to go on a mission trip, you went to solve problems, you went to give money, you went to be the hero. And we've learned some hard things along the way, because in part that's the way we were instructed to go, and that's the way it started. But our desire to be part of something that was long-term, mutually beneficial, and self-sustaining, would provide self-sustaining solutions, has continued to fuel that. And so wondering, does our church family get what we're doing? I think that's a great question. And we probably didn't for the first 3 or 4 years. But then we had a leak in our roof, and leaked into the foyer of our church building. And I remember sitting down at our board meeting, and we're like, okay, what's this going to cost? And they're like, the number came up, and they're like, well, that's the equivalent of 2 houses for 2 families in El Salvador. We can deal with a hole in the roof. Why would we take away the opportunity for families to hear about Jesus and to have a secure and safe house? And that's when we started to realize that our church was getting a hold of this. You know, and if you were to walk in here, our sanctuary was built in 1979. It doesn't look all that different. And anytime we try to go and make any kind of significant improvement to that space in particular, people are like, we only really use this space once or twice a week. This money can be better served in other places. And so we definitely, as a whole, our church family gets that. Now, certainly you have to kind of re-educate because people come and go. And so we kind of continually teach that. But as a whole, that understanding and from that part of it. And then probably the flip side of that is, or the other perspective of that is, okay, well, what about us? Well, actually, the Lord is looking after our needs, even while we're not trying to draw attention to our needs. And that's it's really bizarre in that sense. And so it's always very humbling. It's a humble reminder every year of God's provision and God's desire to see his people move out and to bring, just to embody the message of Jesus as well as speaking the message of Jesus in all that we do. So I'd say as a whole, it's shaping us 52 weeks a year, not just the 1 week a year that we're going.
You know, I've had a number of conversations over the years with families who have come to Costa Rica to be a part of this ministry who have said afterwards, we changed the way that we spend money as a family after that mission trip.
Right.
This is the first time I've had someone say, basically, our whole church changed the way that we spend money as a church.
Yeah.
Because of this missional relationship that we're committed to. I think that's
yeah.
great.
Yeah, I think one of the bigger, longer lasting byproducts of that is when we establish our budget, we title our budget, the whole thing is a mission budget. And so some of that mission is local, some of that mission is global. Everything we do is about mission. And so we try to communicate that even through boring financial statements. We try to communicate that message. And so, yeah, it is crazy because we brought that up. So last year, we actually brought up the idea of changing the sanctuary, the carpeting and the lighting and as our next focus. And then somebody suggested, well, what about the parking lot? That's what the whole community uses, and it's in bad shape. And so we said, okay, is that what we want to do? We want to focus on the parking lot because that's what everybody uses, not just the sanctuary where, you know, it's just primarily just Sundays and maybe one other day a week. So we said, okay, we're going to do it. We'll do the parking lot. We'll focus on the parking lot. And then this cheer erupted, which was incredible. I had no idea. That completely caught me off guard. So I guess that was another recent indication. People get what we're doing and why we're doing it. It's a unique thing. It's really cool to be part of.
If you could pinpoint a couple of lessons that you've learned from the Salvadorians over the last 15 years, what would a couple of those lessons be?
Yeah, I think as you're well familiar in our mission endeavors, we think of poverty as in North Americans, especially in Westerners in particular, we think of poverty in terms of economics. I think one of the things that hits us hardest when I first went, and certainly now as I get the privilege of seeing this experience through the eyes and the hearts of others, is yes, they might have an economic poverty, but we have a poverty of relationship. We have a poverty of generosity that is well outmatched by our brothers and sisters in El Salvador. And so for all that they have been through in their recent history, dealing with the measures of distrust as a result of civil war and the economic hardships and the oppression that they've been under from other governments, superpowers, as well as their own corruption over the years, there's been a lot of stuff, but there is an incredible resilience and a beauty in especially among the poorest of the poor, where there is such a richness in a hospitality and a generosity of what is mine is ours, right? And then in that relationship, the value they have on relationship is incredibly rich. And it speaks to the poverty within us. It just really pulls, no matter how big and strong you think you might be, it affects everybody. And so I think those are some of the things that I personally have valued. And I know that's what I hear more and more so. It's all of a sudden like we're blinded to the economic difference. And we realize we're just people And then when you realize we're all people equally created in the image of God, and then they have something that God has in store for us to learn from them, it's incredibly powerful to realize. And so that's one of the things that we try to do as we prepare people, is to realize, yes, you have something that you're going to give, but you have something that God wants to give you. And if we walk into those communities, those villages, with the idea that God has something to teach me, something to give to me through the people we're going to meet, it changes everything. And it always does.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's hit on humility. Mm-hmm. He's hit on compassion and companionship. Mm-hmm. I think you've hit on all the things that we try to talk about. Abiding is a word that we use very often. And then you talked about being at the table. The table is where we want to sit as equals in bringing that part of the kingdom of heaven on earth.
Yeah. You know, one of the passages familiar, right? Psalm 23, we read that with great familiarity. And there's the part in Psalm 23 where he says, I'll prepare a table before your enemies. Like, I never really understood that until I sat with a community of people in a village on a mountain in El Salvador. And here we are having lunch or dinner or whatever it was. And I thought, there's an enemy of division that says we shouldn't be here, whether it's economics, geographics, race, whatever it is. And there's an enemy of hatred that has existed in that country for so long, and distrust. And the poverty is an enemy. There's so much. And yet here we are in the midst of all of that. And God has set a table for us, and he's among us. And in that recognition, when you have that and you share that meal in the name of Jesus, you realize he does prepare a table for us in the presence of our enemies. And it's so powerful. It's just an incredible thing to behold. And it's one of the benefits of the nature of these trips is with shelter. It opens this door right into the heart of God, and you just cannot, it's just so palpable in that sense.
And so Dave, as we were talking a couple of weeks ago on our reunion Zoom with our favorite people across the world, how you were talking about a new ministry that you have delved into. Do you want to tell us about it?
Yeah, I really appreciate you asking about that. One of the realities of working in Central America is just the number of people who are trying to escape Central America. There's a number of them, obviously, who can do it legally, but there's a number of illegal means, and that leaves people open. They're much more vulnerable to human traffickers, and they're victimized or abused, and some of them are killed along that journey. And so understanding that reality was certainly been part of this journey, learning in El Salvador. And then realizing with that human trafficking happens in all of those forms in our countries and often goes unnoticed. And so probably shortly after we began working with shelter in El Salvador, we also then began working with International Justice Mission in Canada, in just to understand the nature of human trafficking in our country. And in particular, in our province of Ontario, over 60% of human trafficking that occurs in Canada occurs in our province. And the major highways in Ontario, because that's where the majority of Canadians live, is in the southern part of Ontario. And there's major highways that run along there. They call it the 400 series of highways. And those are the corridors that mostly young women get moved up and down. And so gaining an understanding of that, and then recognizing that we're sitting on the corridor, it really, the challenge for us was, okay, what do we do with this information? And then through the pandemic, our leadership team at the church, let's take this time. We have some time. So let's take this time and discern what else can we do that is needed by our community that maybe nobody else is doing. That was kind of the criteria that we went into that pandemic period with. And out of that, we came out of it with this concept of creating the Greater Glass Company. And the Greater Glass Company exists to address some of the gaps in human sex trafficking in our area of Ontario as a byproduct of everything else that's going on in Canada. And so it's called Greater because of the great need, great tragedy that is affecting. The majority of victims are Canadian-born women, and 90%, 96% are Canadian-born women. A significant portion of that are girls between the ages of 12 and 19. So they come from all classes, all income levels. And so we want to address some of the gaps that exist. And some of those gaps are in preventing, is helping students, especially young students, increase their, protect them from the vulnerabilities that exist, to build up their confidence in their understanding of who they are, their purpose, so that they're less susceptible to being lured into these things. And then the other, so that's on the front end. And then there's a lot of good work going on for survivors right now. But on the far end of that, there is no safe house in our area for victims of human trafficking. They need special care. And so that's our long-term goal, is to establish a safe house for victims so that they can have the proper directed care that they need here in this area. Our desire is to work on the front end with students and education and awareness to the general public, and then with the goal of establishing a safe house here in the next few years.
I'd love to hear some specifics, if you can, about how exactly you're doing. Are you going into schools to do that? Or is it people coming into the church to get that kind of training?
It's yes, all of them. So right now, getting into schools is a real challenge. So however we can do it. And we really started in earnest last year. And our desire is to elevate, because it's people don't want to know that this stuff goes on. And it really, I think a study just recently came out where Canada is one of the top four countries of consumers of sexual exploitation online. And so, and the United States is also in that top four, by the way. So we know that there's a consumption issue in our culture, embedded in our culture. And so we have to confront that. And I can tell you from, you know, the local organizations, they do a really excellent job. But one of the places that they can't get into are churches. And one of the conversations that most churches don't want to hear about, it's not a good Sunday morning topic, but we need to hear about it, is cleaning up this. Like, we have to clean up our desires, our consumption that helps perpetuate these notions that girls and women are expendable commodities, and learn to appreciate them for the value that God has created them to be. And so our desire is to work in the gaps where these other organizations aren't, and primarily that'll be churches, youth groups, men's groups, and if we can get into schools with this, to be able to build positive messaging on self-worth, then that'll be a byproduct of developing these relationships.
It's daunting and inspiring at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, I'm so thankful for the counseling program that we have as part of this ministry.
Yeah.
But I hate the fact that we have to have a counseling program.
Right.
And I'm thankful that you, in that season of discernment as a congregation, had the clarity to recognize this need. But I'm sure it's daunting, but hopefully also empowering for the church.
Yeah.
To have identified it and said collectively, yes.
Yeah. It's heavy to think about and to read about and to consider. But one of the reasons why we decided to develop a separate entity was to move it outside the confines and the perception of it's our church's thing, because it's too big. It's too big an issue. Yeah. And so creating a separate organization allows us to develop greater partnerships and hopefully expands the opportunities we have to provide, to amplify the good voices that are already existing in our community around these issues. And so one of the means, another reason why it's called Greater is because we sit on the shores of the Great Lakes system. We find we have a social enterprise piece to this, where we take beach glass that we find on the shores of the Great Lakes. And then in part of our presentation is, even when I meet people, I put a piece of beach glass in their hands. And I ask them to tell me where that beach glass, what was that beach glass in its original form? But to realize when it washes up on a beach, we can easily just discard it. Mm-hmm. But how many waves have hit that? How many times did it hit the bottom of the floor? How far did it travel? And then the last question is, can this still be made beautiful? And the answer to that is yes. In fact, so what we're doing is taking that beach glass and we're creating jewelry out of that beach glass as a metaphor for the fact that that there can be beauty out of brokenness. There can be wholeness, the redemption that comes, restoration that comes despite the brokenness that exists. And so that's kind of what we're doing. In fact, probably later this week, maybe early next week, we'll have an Etsy store open up as well. So that's kind of the means, that's kind of the practical piece to that. And so that again allows us another means of communicating this through workshops, through craft shows to get in front of people with this message before. So we don't pile up on the counseling end, right? We're starting, we want to try to stem that at the beginning so that there's less women, especially who get caught in this thing.
That's beautiful. Everybody has a story.
Everyone has a story. That's our tagline. Yeah. Everyone has.
Is it really? Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. Don't give it. I'm sure I could just sound smart.
Yeah. Whether it's a piece of glass or an individual. And so our thought is, you know, people understand that you can make something beautiful out of a broken piece of jewelry. But so we can't give up on the brokenness of others, even when they come out of difficult situations. It's a discover, restore journey are our key points on that. And the journey idea is it's a long road of recovery for a survivor. It's not necessarily a smooth, beautiful ending. But we're committed as followers of Jesus. We have the capacity to walk a long road with people in their brokenness so they understand the beauty that is existing through restoration.
Sounds like that broken banquet table is going to be made whole one day.
Oops. I love the name of that podcast.
It was all him.
Yeah, I love it.
Haven't contributed anything since then.
At all.
Yeah. At all. That's
weird. Came up with a catchy name.
Well, Dave, is there something else that we haven't asked you that you wish that we had asked you?
You know, so having served in ministry in different capacities, really since the time of entering into this relationship with Jesus, but especially now 23 years in formal full-time ministry, one of the questions that I do get asked is why do you keep doing that, right? And when attrition rate is incredibly high, especially kind of post-pandemic. So why, I think that's an important question.
Why do you keep doing it, Dave?
Because I think, as I think back even to my own, where I was when I was 17, 18, 19, I was really broken. I didn't understand what the world was doing to me. I certainly didn't understand that God cared enough about me and that Jesus was offering me a life that he was exchanging his life for mine so that I could experience an abundant, full life. I didn't understand. I didn't know about that. I had to learn about that. How many other people have to learn about that or deaf or blind to that because of the brokenness that they've experienced, that they are experiencing? And so to bring the mercy and the mission and the message of Jesus to one little boy or one little girl, one man, one woman, that's why I get up every morning, whether it's coaching basketball or serving as a pastor in a church or getting to start this enterprise with the Greater Glass Company or anything else we do. That was why I participated in our doctoral program. I wanted to see what God was doing worldwide. And we met people that further inspired that. We're willing to sacrifice their daily lives for the sake of others because of the example that Jesus gave to them. So that's why I do what I do. And until Jesus comes again, I'm going to keep doing that as long as the Lord enables me to do it. And he fills me with these ideas and sends people and resources to make those things happen. It's incredibly humbling every single day.
Dave, you inspire me and you have for 10 years. And I'm very thankful for who God called you to be and the influence you have been on my life. So happy birthday, Dave. Wow. Happy birthday.
Well, thanks. And, you know, March Madness is around the corner. And I always have while I never pick them, I do always have a little piece of me that wants to see the Tar Heels do well.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you.
You know, I was just getting ready to say how nice it had been to meet you and happy birthday, and then you have to go and do that.
I don't know if I've ever met a more avid Tar Heel fan in my life. So,
and you have zero skin in the game, Dave. I mean, why even? Oh, man.
You went to Duke.
No way.
I did. Wife, here we are.
Zach, my wife cheers for Duke all the time. We are a house divided in our basketball affections. She, for whatever reason, she loves Duke as well.
Well, I got to think of a bunch of reasons. But if ever you needed proof of just the grace that is possible at the table,
well,
here are Ashley and I sitting together.
The episode, all of it's a March Madness edition that you as a Dukie and a Tar Heel are co-hosting this endeavor. That is a great topic.
I think we could have Dave interview us about that.
There is a lot of brokenness at that banquet. You know, all jokes aside, I'm glad that Ashley introduced us and that we've had you on. And I really appreciate what you shared with us. And I know you've given our listeners a lot to think about. And, you know, gosh, love to come and see your church and your 50-year-old sanctuary and learn more about what you guys are doing in the community. I want to see your new parking lot. And
Lord willing, we'll be here next year. We got to save up for that, but we'll get there.
Well, thank you for your time and for joining us. We really appreciate you being on The Broken Banquet.
Great to be with you. God bless you. Thanks for doing what you're doing and amplifying the voice of the broken around the table that the Lord calls us to. I think it's exciting.
Amen.
Right. Amen.
Bye, Ashley.
Bye, Will.
Bye, Dave.
You've been listening to The Broken Banquet, a podcast by Will Bailey and Ashley Goad. Music provided by Irene and the Sleepers. Join us next week for another episode. He's prepared the table. All things are ready. Come to the feast.